behind us this morning.
Gentlemen, can I have your attention?
Hey, Tom.
We don't have a quorum yet. Can you give us 2 minutes?
Yes, you do.
Do we?
Is it, right
here? Yeah, we do.
Oh, okay. Okay, this is where I was walking last night. I was walking around here last night. You see places like that.
No.
Or is your leg helping you find somebody?
You can sit right up here if you want.
This is the area you're really concerned about.
Discuss that.
Yeah.
Right. This is the jiggly line of the town law. Plus, or not plus. It's the comic, so it's between 9A and the comic.
Okay.
This is the residential area.
We have two judges here that have to get back to court. Can we start our meeting, please?
Judges, okay. How are you?
And how are you doing? Don't we have more people?
Well,
let's get everybody.
We're starting, because I don't want to hold them up. They are busy.
I understand. They went up missing court.
Well, he's got a trial.
I'm in the middle of the trial. I have to. I promised the lawyers I'd be back by 2.
Okay,
actually,
thank you.
They're not.
Hi, judges.
But I told them
where are you going, Mr. Abernathy?
This is Ryan.
Okay, I'm going to call to order the meeting of the Legislation Committee, starting a half an hour late. It's 1:30, and we're joined by Legislators Burton, Myers, our Chair, Chairman Jenkins, and Legislator Williams. We have as guest today Administrative Judge Schenkman and Judge DiBella, who have kindly consented to take time from their trial schedules to discuss with us the judiciary's role in the firearm licensing process. We began the discussion last week where we had a description of the role of the county police, and so this week we're going to learn some more about the judiciary's role, and I want to thank both of them for coming. Just want to note for the record, Judge Schenkman and I go back a long, long way. We were both clerk for judges of the New York State Court of Appeals too many years ago than I'd like to remember. It's a pleasure to have him here.
Thank you.
And we have been joined by Legislator Rogowski and Legislator Burks.
I know, you know, it's not my place, and I can't address some of the questions that I know are on your mind, such as the effect of recent Supreme Court decisions on existing statutes. And what I can address as the administrative judge, the administrative processes that we deal with, and some of the interactions that we have with some of the other participants in the licensing process under Section 400 of the penal law. While judges are the persons who grant or deny or revoke licenses, they do so in a somewhat different role than may be customary, which is they, by statute, act as licensing officers. So they are not sitting as jurists, but they are really sitting in a more or less administrative capacity, just as any person who has authority to issue a license, whether it's an alcohol license or, you know, a license to occupy premises or anything else. It's really an administrative process. The intake is through the county clerk's office, principally because there is although it's relatively modest, there is a fee. The county clerk does take in that process. According to the statute, there is a required investigation, including a fingerprint check. That brings the county police into the process. When the paperwork is completed, gets sent up to the judges, the process is essentially, although it can vary, is essentially random. Under the statute, any judge or justice of a court of record who has an office in the county can act as a licensing officer. As a result of, I guess, long-standing practice, the judges who generally get these assignments are the county court judges, although we do have some Supreme Court judges. Judge Murphy, for example, entertains those applications. And the courts proceed to determine them in accordance with, you know, Section 400. Whether Section 400 is good, bad, or indifferent in light of recent Supreme Court decisions. I really can't speak to either. I am sure that as individuals present applications to the judges, whether they are for new licenses, additional licenses, renewals under the five-year renewal provision, people will make those arguments as see fit, and I know that there are a couple of broader-based lawsuits out there that eventually judges will have to decide. So I'd ask you to assume, for purposes of our discussion, that our role is with respect to the existing statutory framework, whether that's good. As I said, assuming that that is valid and enforceable and subject to whatever arguments individual people may wish to make about them. And as I said, our role is largely administrative in the sense that the judges are functioning not as judges. Some of the usual hallmarks of a judicial proceeding do not take place, at least at the licensing stage. They may more commonly on the revocation stage take place, but in terms of an initial licensing, there's no requirement for an evidentiary hearing. There's no quote-unquote adverse party who necessarily needs to receive notice. And what the judge's obligation is to do is to review the papers, assure that the person has met the eligibility requirements set forth in the statute, and determine whether or not to grant the requested license. There is a, I guess, unusual procedure or somewhat different procedure that has sprung up in that with respect to the carry license, the Court of Appeals has recognized that the licensing officer has the discretion not, you know, to limit the purpose for a carry license to particular areas, such as hunting or fishing or something like, or hiking. But that is not statutory. That is up to, that is entirely up to the discretion of the licensing officer, depending upon the, you know, the nature of the application, the reasons for it, and the evaluation that the licensing officer makes under that procedure. And I'm happy to address, you know, any particular questions that I possibly can that you may have with respect to what the courts do.
I have a few, and then I'll open it up to the legislators and the public. So since the court's acting in an administrative capacity, then if the license is denied, I assume the relief is in Article 78, which goes to
that
the
is correct. There have been people who have attempted to, quote-unquote, appeal, and the Second Department has said that that's not the remedy. The remedy is in Article 78 procedure.
Right. And then so there's a Court of Appeals decision that provides that the licensing officer has the discretion to limit the carry license to particular use.
Yeah, in fact, I believe it's I think it's the case is O'Connor against Scarpino, when Judge Scarpino was a county judge.
Right. And could you elaborate, and we discussed this a little earlier, can you just elaborate on the process for the inspections? You know,
well,
how that works?
There's no requirement. You mean a home inspection?
Yeah, the home inspections at a certain point and how that evolves.
I think that as far as I can figure, when Judge West was the administrative judge or the supervising judge for the criminal courts, a practice or rule of thumb developed between the judges that if someone was applying for more than a certain number of licenses for a certain number of weapons, that the judges might request a home inspection. There's nothing in the statute that requires that. We were talking about earlier, that inspection, if you even look at the letters that have been submitted, is not for the purpose of assuring that there is compliance with county law. The letters simply say the licensing officer wants some assurance that the existing weapons are being properly or safely maintained. Is there a magic number? I don't think so. I think a lot depends on, you know, is somebody applying for their 100th weapon? And does that person live in a studio apartment, or is somebody applying for, you know, a second weapon, and the person lives in a big house? Are there children around, or are there not children around? These are all matters that are, you know, I think under the existing law may be considered by judges. They have been considered by judges in their role as licensing officers. But I believe it's a matter of the individual judge's discretion. I don't think a home inspection is certainly not required by law, at least with respect to looking at security issues. There's no requirement of that. And if there is a concern, or the judge has a concern about the issue, it could be addressed in any number of ways. It can be addressed by a phone call to the applicant. It could be addressed through requesting an affidavit. It could be addressed in any number of ways.
That's what I said the other day.
And as I mentioned to the chairman before, and I mean no disrespect, but when the judges have asked for an evaluation with respect to the security or safety of existing weapons, that has not been for the point of view of saying we want to make sure that the person is requiring with the county law. Frankly, that's not a germane consideration. If the person is securing their weapon safely, if the judge had a concern about that before issuing another weapon, if that's addressed in a matter that's satisfactory to a licensing officer, even if it's not quote unquote in compliance with the county law, that may be a matter of county code enforcement, but it's not a matter for licensing under the penal law. There's nothing in the penal law that says that an applicant has to prove or satisfy somebody that they're in compliance with a local law relating to weapons security.
Well, and why one other question, and maybe Justice Bella collaborated. We were given a letter last week that's 3 years old, I understand, where a number of judges expressed a concern regarding the application form.
Well, there are a couple of forms. I think there are a couple of
the booklet and the forms, yeah.
There are a couple of concerns. One is the booklet. I can tell you from having, I did meet with the county clerk, and I did meet separately as well with the judges who are presently involved in dealing with the permitting process under Section 400. I believe that the letter was not responded to, although I would acknowledge and I would thank Commissioner Longworth. Within the past several weeks, I did get from the commissioner a letter and a proposed handbook with revisions that I'm going to circulate to the judges for their comment with respect to some of the issues that the, and I think some of the issues that the judges identified may be addressed, although I don't think all of them, you know, have been. But I will certainly communicate that to the judges, and we'll try to see if we can help facilitate a response. But I think, frankly, the issue goes beyond the handbook. I think the law is fairly clear in the penal law that an application form has to be approved by the state superintendent of police. I think that's pretty clear. If someone were to submit an application that is on a state-approved form, I believe that they would be entitled to do that. The question, of course, is whether a member of the public knows that that's a permissible option. That's another question. But I do think the law is quite clear that the forms of license applications and the forms of licenses themselves must be approved by the state superintendent of police. I think that from the letter and from conversations that we've had, there may be issues about misinformation that may be given by people involved in the process as to what, you know, whether this is in a matter of official policy or otherwise, I really can't speak to. You know, it's not unusual in for people when they tell somebody what they think the law is, they'll say, well, a judge will never do that, or a judge will always do this. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. Although, of course, if it comes from somebody who is involved in the process, it may take on, you know, added weight. But, for example, I know one of the criticisms of the former handbook was that it would say that a carry license might be restricted to certain enumerated activities when that's not the case. Or that there are certain predispositions as to when a carry license would be issued or when it would not be issued. That's really up to the discretion under the current law, up to the discretion of the licensing office. So I think actually working with the judges and the county clerk to address with the police commissioner the handbook may go a long way towards addressing those issues. I know the county clerk, I think, has some of the same feelings. I think there may have been a point in time, even when the applications were taken from the county clerk's office and relocated someplace else. I mean, it would make sense if the county clerk is taking the applications and it becomes known that you have, that's where you go to file them for applications to be available at the county clerk's office. But I do think that we could do a lot better job working together to try to clarify matters so that we don't have some miscommunications or misunderstandings. You know, obviously, each of the judges, when they evaluate the applications, brings to bear his or her own wisdom, judgment, and experience. I think it's probably fair to say, like any other group of human beings, they have differences of opinion, and not everybody would react to the same thing the same way. That happens, but if someone is aggrieved by that, they certainly have their remedies.
Some of them might have been in the majority in the Supreme Court, and some of them might have been in the minority.
As I see it, our role is to fulfill the requirements of the state statute mm-hmm. until such time as there's right. a decision that says we have to do something different. If there's a decision from a court of competent jurisdiction that says we have to do something different, then we'll do something different.
We'll open up to other questions. I agree with what Justice Shanklin just said, because there are already, 2 years ago, we had issues where Judge Nikolai, maybe it was Judge Murphy came before us and talked about it. And this was dealing more with the prior commissioner, I believe, than anything else, and probably the booklet. But my assessment of it, just as you said, Judge, is that you know which judges tend to be more pro-gun and which judges might not be as pro-gun. So it falls to a lot of the judge's discretion. And I guess you could apply that into any area of the law and any facts. But what, if anything, would you recommend that this committee might change?
Well, I'm not sure that actually, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but this is really a matter, this is Section 400 of the state penal law. So that's what we're obligated to be involved in. Your committee wishes to make a recommendation to the state legislature, I mean, that's certainly your prerogative. Obviously, there are some things in Section 400 that are Westchester-specific, such as the firearm safety
course.
That's Westchester-specific. There are some other things, I think, that are Nassau, Suffolk, and Westchester-specific, dealing with
storage.
The relicensing. Mm. The issue of recertification.
Right. 5 years.
5 years. So the legislature has made, when it's seen fit to do so, changes that apply only in certain areas. There's a whole different. Even on the issue of licenses, there's a big difference between the effect of a license issued outside the city of New York and the effect of a license issued inside the city of New York. Those are legislative judgments. And as I said, even on this issue about home inspection, as I see it, that's a matter that Under those circumstances, those judges involved in those applications thought that that was something that they wanted as in their role as licensing officer, but I don't believe from any of the letters that I've seen that that was for the purpose of ensuring compliance with a county law or not. In fact, I believe that practice of, in some instances, asking for an inspection predates any county storage law. And, you know, as I said, if a judge is satisfied that the person is, you know, a judge had a question in his or her mind that as to whether or not, whether because of the multiplicity of weapons or for some other reason that there was an issue about the safety of the weapons at a location, if the judge is satisfied with that, even if the practice is not in strict conformity with the county law, it may have other consequences in terms of enforcement of the county law. I'm not speaking to whether or not the county can or should enforce its own law, but strictly in terms of the license procedure, the fact that it's not in conformity or not in conformity with the county code does not necessarily mean that the application would have to be denied for that reason. Some judge might decide that if somebody's not in compliance with county code, that goes to their moral character. Somebody else might take a different view. I think another matter that came up that I would spend a moment or two on is the issue about police recommendations. I think in talking to the judges that while a police recommendation is not something that is statutorily required, the judges find it helpful. Not so much for the recommendation, but from the point of view of flagging what the police officer's concern might be. So that, you know, when the judge gets a giant stack of papers, if there's somebody who's flagged an issue, that is helpful. On the other hand, I am certainly aware of circumstances where the investigating officer has recommended one way and then his or her superiors have gone another way. In talking to the judges, I do think that the judges may give more weight or tend to give more weight to the views of the person who actually did the investigation than the weight of a superior who did not. But I think, again, the law is clear, and I think our practice is clear, that the fact that an officer, police official, recommends against the application does not mean that the judge should deny it for that reason alone. I think the law is also clear that if there is a reason that is standing in the way of an approval, the licensing officer is bound to provide the applicant with an opportunity to address that issue. It doesn't necessarily mean an evidentiary hearing. It can be by a phone call. It can be by a personal interview. There's nothing that in the law that requires that it have to be quote unquote on the record. It's simply required that the person be afforded an opportunity to address whatever the problem is. If they can successfully address whatever the issue is that the licensing officer has, then a license can be granted. If they can't, they can't. But they're entitled to that opportunity. The law does require that if an application is denied, that the licensing officer state the reasons for that denial. And it has to be more than, well, the police didn't think it was a good idea.
Legislative Parsons, you have a follow-up?
With respect to the judges that asked for the sampling of the housing, the house inspection orders, were any of those individuals turned down once the inspector went on?
You know, I haven't looked. I mean, I did get sample letters. You know, maybe Judge DeBella can speak to it, because I think he got, did anybody actually get denied?
As a result of an inspection.
I have one letter asking for an inspection, and just was curious, out of the nine or so that we might have over here, were anybody denied after they did?
I think one applicant was
seeking seven guns.
So. I actually saw a couple of letters of, you say, mine that have come out. Mm-hmm. Most of them were in 2008. With regard to home inspections and the number, I mean, if the county issues a statute that says once you get five, then you should be in a home inspection. That's certainly something I'm going to consider. I think every judge is trying to follow every law. But I'm not so sure. I agree with Alan 100%. I'm not so sure that the county needs to legislate that area. And I believe that I've been involved in pistol permits since the late 80s. I was with Judge Scarpino and the principal researcher and drafter of Matter of O'Connor versus Scarpino. my dad's a cop. I've been around guns my whole life. But so, you know, with regard to sending out letters, with regard to inspections, I think some of that I do because there's a county law. If there's no county law, then I look at an application, and I still do, and there might be some things about it that indicate to me someone who's involved in this for a long period of time that there might be a need. For example, I had a case that showed a letter reminded me of. It was a rather unique case. Someone had had about 20 or 30 guns, and they'd had a previous home inspection. They now had an application made before me, and it was for the 40th weapon or 50th weapon. They required some 20 or 30 additional weapons in the interim. Now, when you look at it, if they say they have a century-safe model so-and-so, and you know this to be a 12-inch by 12-inch safe, 50 guns don't fit in this set. See, you know, I know it sounds like to most of you when you hear about a problem that it's to everyone. But some of these are small pimp tricks on a huge tapestry. And I would suggest that in pistol permit licensing in general, I'd love to know, and I don't know, because the county keeps it, how many pistol licenses are asked for and how many are granted. Because I guarantee you 98% of all pistol licenses are granted. There are problems with few. Inspections are just one aspect of it. I agree with Alan also that I believe that the discretion that licensing officers have, I don't think it's need a county law to compel that if we feel there's something about that application that might suggest that these guns are not being stored in a way or by a person of good judgment and in a manner that's safe. Then we would probably want to look into it, and I think the discretion is broad enough. And on that last point, I know there are many different views of it. I think you have to understand again, and I think Alan made a great point, I'm not sure how many non-lawyers really recognize the import of, we're not judges in this, we're like licensing officers. We're bound by the Court of Appeals and the Appellate Division. If they've issued opinions on these topics, we are not authorized to go our own way because we have a different view of what the law should be. You know, we're bound to follow, and I've been forced to write letters to people who have questions many, many times saying, well, the Appellate Division has said this, and the Court of Appeals has said this. I'm not issuing people what my personal views are. I'm just, as a licensing officer, I'm bound as an administrative officer to follow the rules of the highest courts of the state of New York. And until some other court higher than the Court of Appeals speaks, we have no discretion other than to follow the law that gives us lots of discretion.
You know, one other area I just wanted to mention is that the law does require a police investigation.
Right.
And the fingerprinting.
Right.
The law also requires that judges decide these applications within 6 months of presentation. While it is certainly understandable that there are times when the fingerprint results may take a while because they're not regarded by the police as a high priority item, that if, you know, somebody, you know, as you can imagine, there are daily requests for fingerprint checks for people who, incident to arrest or incident to some ongoing police investigation. These may, to a certain extent, as a matter of police priority, get, you know, something of a back burner treatment. On the other hand, the judge is obligated under the statute, the judge cannot decide it within 6 months, to indicate the reasons, you know, for that delay. And obviously anything that the county police can do to assist the judges in getting these matters resolved in a timely basis would be helpful.
And the judges have met, and we've agreed to the best that we can to try to get them out of our office within 24 to 48 hours after we get them. No judge keeps these things around for 6 months.
I I know you guys, you both under time constraints, so I want to, I know Mr. Avenanti, let's say, might have had a question or comment, and then Mr. Somavia might have a question or comment. So
I thought the statute mandated that you refer to the police department.
Yeah, there is a requirement that there is an investigation.
So obviously there's an implication that there's going to be some kind of report coming back.
You know, I understand that, but it also says, the statute also says that they're supposed to do it without, I think it refers to unnecessary delay, and there's also a step provision which says that they're supposed to be decided within 6 months. So I think you could reasonably read that together so as to mean that the police have an obligation to get the completed materials to the court, to the judge, in time for the judge to render a timely decision.
Any other legislators have questions?
Sure.
No. Mr. Somavia, we're joined by Scott Somavia, who's president of the Westchester Firearm Owners Association. Do you have any questions?
Right now, no. Some of the discussion we've had on the walkover has answered a lot of ours. Basically, it's the inspection's a problem. The other is the recommendations. And we don't, it's not that we don't like the recommendations, but a lot of licensing officers follow the recommendations. And even some of the subordinates in the police, their first recommendation gets out, and you don't even see that. And it's, you're seeing the recommendation from the police, which is more like a pre-bias of a jurist of your decision making it. It should be, did he have criminal intent? Did he have to do anything? Or, you know, did he beat his wife, his kids, or she beat his husband and the kids? It doesn't really matter. It should just go straight in. This is what it is. His mental background check is passed and all. I don't know if I'll agree with
well, I'm not sure.
Because people, when there is a recommendation denial, most judges that I talked to, the cops said denial, so they went right with it.
Well, I don't think a judge could write a decision on a denial that simply said, well, I'm denying this because the police said I should. I think it needs a little bit. I think the law is pretty clear that it needs a little bit more than that. Now, it may be that the judge does agree with the reason given by the police officer. And as I said, in talking to the judges who issued this, that they appreciate having a recommendation, at least not so much, as I said, for the result, but more to identify the issue, meaning that if there's something in the person's background or something that the police have identified as an issue, then it's helpful to know about that. But I think the law is pretty clear that, at least in terms of writing a decision, you can't just simply say, you know, I'm denying this because the police said I should. It has to be a little bit, you know, more, and the person who's the applicant is entitled to an opportunity to address that issue, meaning that whether it's done by, you know, a telephone call, whether it's done by ask them to submit a letter or submit something, it's really discretionary.
I think it
we're just one more thing. What we're seeing is a boilerplate answer to those. It's the same letter, just with a different name and address has changed from the judge. It's the same, and it's just basically the same reasons why they can deny you versus an independent. What you did wrong. It was criminal intent. He, you know, he did this. He was arrested 6 times, but he got lawyered up and got out of it. You know, that's one issue.
But if the,
I can't recommendations get lawyered
up. With all due respect, I can't speak to the individual judgment of an individual judge faced with a particular application. That really is a matter up to how that judge goes about doing it or not doing it. You know, just as an analogous circumstance. And I'm sure Judge DiBello would speak to this from, you know, his criminal court days. There are lots of times when the probation department or other people will recommend a particular sentence to somebody who's been convicted of a crime. The judge may or may not go along with it. If the judge goes along with it, the judge may recite some of the same factors that were identified in the probation report. The judge may say something different. That's really up to how a judge chooses to craft the decision, and if somebody disagrees with the judge, then you know, there is a remedy, which is to bring in an Article 78 proceeding, and the appellate division can make a different decision if they think that that's appropriate. But what's it really in the practical mindset of a judge when the judge makes a decision? I really can't speak to. I can only tell you from talking to the judges that even those judges who don't necessarily believe that the police role should be perhaps as intrusive as it may have become over the past year or two or three, necessarily object to getting a recommendation. If nothing else, it's just another piece of information, as long as it doesn't become the fact of the recommendation itself doesn't become dispositive. Meaning, somebody could say, look, this person should be rejected because, and a lot depends on the because, not on the fact that the recommendation was made.
These recommendations, by the way, are relatively new. For 10 or 15 years, through three other administrative judges, I think a lot of the licensing officers asked, would the police provide some recommendation or at least state their reason as to why, what they think, just as a help to go through if you have a basket full of 80 or 90 of them in a day. And again, this is a side thing we do. It's not what you do all day as a judge. And they refused. For many, many years, the police would not provide any recommendation. So ultimately, only recently do we get any. And again, just to put it in perspective, I would say that the highest correlation is between police recommending approval and it being approved, far more than them recommending denial and getting denied.
Yeah.
Because I grant licenses where they recommend denial. But it's a much rarer case in my experience to deny one they've asked to approve.
Also, I just point out, because these are not adjudicative proceedings, there's nothing that precludes a judge from dealing with a license application from somebody the judge knows. In fact,
there's no recusal or anything.
There's no need. In fact, if some judge happens, for example, to live next door to the person who's applying, that may lead added weight to whatever judgment the judge
either
is going to make.
Either way, right?
That does happen. Which is, I know these people, and therefore, they're good people. That also happens. When I said that it's random, it is generally random. But there are times when, it's perfectly legitimate for a licensing officer to consider his or her own personal knowledge of the individuals involved.
And I take it the standard of review on an Article 78 would be arbitrary.
So arbitrary and capricious.
I just want to properly welcome
Judge, because he sat here for years as the county attorney, and some of us.
Notice how nice we've been to him today.
A lot nicer than I used to say. Work for you.
He was at a different size table those days, a different table, but he's been here before.
And because you're a lawyer and he's a lawyer.
Right.
And he's a lawyer.
Thanks for coming. Just to wrap up, our concern initially was our own law, and your perspective on this is interesting because, we have to be concerned about whether our law is constitutional or not. Your issue about the independent discretion is separation of powers. That's not our issue.
I'm sure somebody's going to embarrass me.
He probably drafted our law.
But I do think, wearing another hat, probably about 10 or 12 years ago, I may have issued some memoranda about the scope to which the county can act. Because another issue, it's not for me to advise you on, but there undoubtedly is a question about state preemption, which is the extent to which you have a state statute that preempts the area, and to what extent can the county operate within an area that's subject to state regulation. That's why I say to you, with all due respect, it's not that I don't value the work of your of the board and the legislation that the board produces. But in terms of looking at this narrowly and saying, well, what's the job of the licensing officer? Well, the job of the licensing officer is to assure that an application is determined in accordance with Section 400 of the penal law, no more, no less.
One additional question, very, very briefly.
Although, as hard as that might be to Tom.
I was going to say that.
Right. Quick question. I don't know if it says quick answer. Have you looked at the application, the way the law is being applied, to see whether there is any problems with constitutionality on the basis of...
I can't address that. I mean,
it's like a Supreme Court nomination, you know, before the Judiciary Committee.
Tom, I honestly can't address that. Technically, although I haven't done one in a while, I'm a licensing officer, and I can't tell you what I would likely say if somebody were to say, well, Judge, with all due respect, I think you have to give me this because the United States Supreme Court says you have to. So I really can't speak to an issue that might come before me, either in a licensing role or in a potential decision. This whole context of this discussion, I'm asking you to assume that the current framework of the statute, of a state statute, is lawful and constitutional. And as I said, if somebody, you know, if there's a binding decision that comes down from somebody that says that this is not constitutional at all, or is unconstitutional as applied, then we would have to do something about it. The other thing, I thought you were going to go someplace else, which is that, you know, we take, I think, a certain number of things, what's that, say, on good faith reliance, meaning that I haven't asked, and I don't particularly know whether the current application form or questionnaire that's being used by the county has been approved by the superintendent of state police. If it turns out that it's not, and somebody presented an application that was on a state approved form, but it wasn't on the county approved form, you know, there would be a very good argument that says that we have to take it. I don't know that issue has come up. That may be an issue more about public education than it is about anything else.
Well, we appreciate your efforts.
On the other, you know, because I don't think anybody's ever gone behind, any of the judges have ever gone behind this to say, by the way, you know, to the police commissioner, have you gotten state approval for this?
Is there any indication that our practices vary widely from what's going on in the rest of the state? I mean, because the licensing offices from north of New York City are all the Supreme Court judges.
No, a licensing office, actually they're not. A licensing officer outside of certain areas, for the most part, is any judge of a court of record.
Oh, any judge?
Any judge of a court of record.
Town judge?
Town judges are not considered
It would be the city court and up. As a matter of practice, however, I think for administrative convenience, the county clerk is the clerk that takes in the papers. One of the practical problems is even though the statute doesn't really refer to who is the clerk who's going to be handling the paperwork, somebody has to do it and somebody has taken the money because there is a fee involved. And the county clerk's office does a very good job of, you know, accounting for the funds and organizing the paperwork.
So in the rest of the state, do they use other judges?
I can't speak to that. Theoretically, I suppose someone could submit an application to a city court judge in Westchester County. I don't know that that's ever done. I don't know what they would do with it. I don't know that the clerk of the city court would know what to do with it. Theoretically, though, I do think it's there is a value to having the practice centralized.
Sounds
but,
like a proposal
but
for state
it's not. For example, just again, historically. We have judges who are residents of the county who are judges of the Court of Claims.
Right.
For example, at the moment we have Judge Moley, who's our supervising judge in the criminal courts. We have Judge Lorenzo, and we have Judge Holdman. All three of them happen to be residents of Westchester County. And since the Court of Claims is a court of record, they will take their share of pistol permit applications.
But that's distributed centrally through the central.
The county clerk's office does that, and what the county clerk does try to do is distribute that work equally, so that of the judges who take them, no one gets you know, too many and no one gets too few.
The point of my question
Tom,
though, was
you've got to go, right?
I'm sorry, one last.
The last question was, has anybody demonstrated or alleged that the practices in Westchester County vary greatly from what's happening in the rest of the state?
Maybe that's a question you have to ask Mr. Somerville. I can't really speak to that. I can only speak to what we do.
Right.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bella, take care, everybody. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for visiting with your fellow branch of government.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
I can answer those questions if you'd like.
Go ahead while they're coming in. Bring in the next crowd.
Tom, basically when we had the home rule message we sent in, which we wanted a person to be able to practice, and then modifying the administrative procedure in the county clerks, we found that at this point, there's been some changes, but 54% are done by the county, the rest are done by state police. As far as the forms upstate, besides us, there was Erie who got sued, again, without permission to use the same three-page piece with a cover letter. Even in Sullivan County, I have one. It basically says, hi, how are you? You got to get your four character references. You need these pictures. They got to be taken within 30 days. It basically goes
over the whole thing. So you're saying that the other counties don't do as much as we do?
Correct.
We probably should talk about this offline.
We're going to move on to the next topic.
Okay. We'll talk about it offline.
I'll catch up with you.
You got it.
Yeah, thank you.
We are joined now. Today we're having all these illustrious guests. We have the administrative judge, Judge Cabella. Now we have our election commissioners, Republican and Democratic. And this
gone
is
from the non-political to the political.
But we also want to open the meeting of the Housing and Planning. This is a joint meeting.
Okay.
We already convened as a legislation committee.
Okay. And
I wonder which committee is serving lunch.
I'm going to sit in the back of the room and eat my lunch right now for you guys.
We've got one, two, three.
Do you have a quorum? I hope so.
Yes, we have a forum.
We have a forum, right.
Yes.
Four for a quorum.
I note that I hereby open the meeting of the Housing, Planning, and Operations Committee, and note the presence of a quorum in the presence of myself, Judy Myers, John Nona, Martin Rogowski, and Alfreda Williams.
Okay. This we have a proposal to extend the term of the commissioners of the Board of Elections from 2 years to 4 years. Just some background. The election law section 3-200 subdivision. Let me get the right section here. I just had it. Term of office 3-202 says the local legislative body may at any time determine that the terms of office, the county legislative body of any county other than New York City or Schenectady, interestingly enough, may determine that the commissioners of elections thereafter appointed shall serve for a term of 4 years. The original term provided is 2 years. So we have the ability to extend the term to 4 years. And I think that provision in the county charter now provides for 2 years. So we're being asked to extend it to 4 years, which we have the authority to do under the election law. And I guess, gentlemen, you're here to tell us why we should do that.
Yes, sir.
Sounds like a good idea. But
sounds like a good idea. It's a request from both parties, Republican and Democratic parties. As you know, the election commissioners are unique. And it's always brought into it that of the election commissioners and their role in terms of county government on terms of operation. Doug was saying to me coming over here, in terms of, as you see, we have a new commissioner, Doug Colty, who's replaced Commissioner Carolyn Sutherland, who took the package. And with my years of service, I was too eligible for the package, and we talked about it. And I may never see those 32 years again. However, Doug said, coming over, he said, can you imagine what would have happened if you and Carolyn had left at the same time? We've been dealing with two new, fresh commissions in a time when the county is changing, the state is changing its whole voting system that, quite frankly, is not understood by a whole lot of people, and that commissioners are still in the process of learning. In the 9th Judicial District, the other commissioners are four-year term. In the state, there are 62 commissioners, and there are 29 of them that are four-year term. It's not anything unique. If you say it in terms of check and balance or control, we're automatically controlled by the election law and by the Supreme Court and the Appellate Division and the Court of Appeal, as anyone who's run for office. Our decision, and I feel that when this law was crafted, it was one of the better election law, believe it or not, in the country, because it requires to be headed by two persons, Democrat and Republican commission. And our decisions, whether to place someone on the ballot or in anything we do, has to be unanimous. If it is a split between us, it goes to the voter, which means that that person just automatically comes on. If there is a split between us, or if we reject something, then we are then on the fast track to Supreme Court, if those persons so desire, and so on and so on. Both parties feel that it would be better for continuity and be better for less influence, as in other county. You say, what influence? All government is good government if it's in the will of those who would respect it to be good government. Now, I understand you that these positions are strictly party positions. It's a unique one in the state of all election commissioners in the 62 counties. In other words, when we're interviewing people for a job, we're supposed to ask them by law a question that no other commissioners or no other person interviewing for a job is allowed to ask. Which party are you registered in? Because the law states specifically, if you're not registered in the Democratic Party, I can't hire you. If you're not registered in the Republican Party, Doug can't hire you. If Doug or I should change our party, we vacate our position immediately. And I don't think people really understands that. And they further updated the law this election cycle in 2010 to say that if a party designated a person to be election commissioner, appoints a person to be election commissioner, that person has to be registered in that party before their designation. Not be appointed and then registered in the party. Are you automatically not eligible? So saying this to say it's strictly a party position by the New York State election law from all aspects. As you know, we come over to the Board of Legislation for approval, but our names are sent by the party. If we are not approved, the party still sends someone else that the legislative body basically cannot put in an election commissioner by election law. But you do have certain power, such as the changing the term. Term cannot be no less than 2 years by election law, such as setting salary or setting the budget. So it's a check and balance. However, we feel to be in consistency with the 9th Judicial District as well as the other 28 counties that both parties, Democrat and Republican. You're supposed to say yes at this point.
You agree. The New York City is, the New York City is 4 years.
Yes.
How about Nassau 4 years too?
I remember Suffolk. Nassau maybe. I remember Suffolk. When you brought up about New York City and Schenectady, I think there's Monroe. At whatever point the assembly, the legislative body of the state, when they set the election law, that assembly person, that senator from that county, from that area, put it in the election law that they would be 4 years, and that's why it's other than they set it that way. Gradually, as it went along, there were some set by the assembly and the senate, and then there were some set by the County Board of Legislature.
They might have had a home rule request to Schenectady also.
That's a possibility.
Any questions? Legislator Rogowski, then Legislator Burris.
Welcome, Commissioners. As you said, Commissioner, it's sort of unique
you know, unique setup, the commissioners of the board. So just curious, and especially since over the last couple of years, you know, we've raised the salaries, which, you know, was appropriate. If this, I guess the county, I never really thought about it, because the county executive, either party, at some point says, you know, I really don't like that commission for whatever reason. Any other commission in the administration, the county executive goes to them and says, I'd like you to leave, and they can leave, right? But I assume commissioners of the Board of Elections, the county executive does not have that
that's why they got 4 years
authority. Well, you do it too, but well, I don't know. Just, I mean, there's an appointment. You need to be reappointed. What is the county executive?
The county executive really has no role other than whatever role he has in his own political party. Whether or not he's a member of that executive committee or executive body or as a county committee person. The commissioners are appointed by the respective party.
And so as the county executive, unlike any other commissioner, the commissioner of elections, the county does not have that kind of relationship.
No.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Can't fire them.
Can't fire them. No, can't fire any other commissioner.
By
can't fire.
Design, boards of elections in the state of New York have to be bipartisan, controlled by two parties, in order to prevent a bureaucracy or have a board of elections that's run by bureaucrats. We are the party in power would ultimately control the Board of Elections and oversee their own elections.
The states
elections.
Where the Secretary of State controls
right.
the elections.
So now, but I guess
the party that person is can be accused of.
But even a Secretary of State is appointed by a political party.
Or elected.
But I guess over the years.
Yeah, by a political party. So it's one party. It's only one. It's one party.
Whether by election or appointment.
Right.
So one political party will ultimately take over that Board of Elections. As
many of us are, all of us are, but as an observer of the process for decades myself, you know, it's not an easy job. I mean, and it's getting more complicated as time goes on. And so the pay is going up. So I was just curious, but the political party, so every 2 years now, essentially the parties make a recommendation, and that's really how the names come forward. Where the term go 4 years, what happens if, because 4 years is a longer time, things happen within the party, and someone else takes over, let's say, as the chairman of the county party, and says, gee, that's a pretty good job. But once you're in, you're protected even from your own parties. Once you have that term, if you're appointed for 4 years.
Until the next 2 years is up. But
now it's 2 years, but yeah. If you're in there, if the four-year term, even if the party changes, so to speak.
Yeah, but somewhere along the line, if it comes in, if it's the same chair at the beginning of the 4 years, then he knows what it's running. If the chair comes in after a two-year stretch of another chair leaving, he has the next 2 years to do the same thing again. But it is no different than, let's say, for example, in any other positions that you're supposed to make a decision with only with minimum amount of influence, such as the assessor's office. State law says that assessor's office is appointed to a 6-year term. The mayor's a 4-year term. The assessor works for the mayor. The mayor comes in, and he has, depends on when he comes in that term, or she comes in, to then appoint a new assessor at that time that term ends. Let's go in civil service office.
Except, oh, I understand.
So it will always be.
But there's always ultimately a elected official. I'm just asking, Craig, just curious. So if you're, let's say you're appointed year one of a 4-year term now. First 6 months into that term, there's change in the party structure, new party chair, and it's like, geez, we never would have, at this point, the new leadership would not be the support of the commission. Well, but you're still there for 3.5 years. I mean, there would be nothing that the new party leadership could do. I'm just trying to.
That's one of the ways it's supposed to be. I've been commissioners three
parties
through three chairs, three different chairs before.
Party chairs. Okay.
And that's the way. But ultimately, you know, when you say to, and we always laugh about it. As you see, Caroline retired from the board after 20 years.
You've lived through serving
a long term, because it's always like, when is a good right time to get rid of the commission?
I just said,
you have an election. Okay.
From a good government perspective, what you want to see happen, even if the party leadership changes hands, in light of the fact there's going to be many changes over the next decade with voting machines, these voting machines may or may not survive future lawsuits, you do want some continuity of experience at these boards of elections.
So a longer term kind of help kind of insulate intense. From kind of turmoil, potential turmoil inside the party. Let's
can
change commissioners.
Turmoil at the right. Board of elections.
To speak on, and you walked into an area, and we were debating this. We see it right up in the paper, talking of conflict of interest in an office where really there's no conflict of interest. When I have to sign something, I sign it as Democratic commissioner, Doug as Republican commissioner. When I go to court, the judge wants to hear from the Democratic commissioner, and he wants to hear from the Republican commissioner. So it's a unique situation where it's automatically set up that by law, long before I was born, and most of us, and
that's why I said the conflict could be between you
it's
and
not.
Your the
it's
conflicts
not.
Could be between you, let's say, and your new party
right.
leadership,
right.
Not public,
not the public and
right.
And you see in terms of, and it's highlighted more. I'm going back to the newspaper, and they said that there was a state villain that wanted to get chairs out of the election. It's not true. There's a state villain that's being held there. But this comes to this point. The original state bill was so that election commissioners could not run for office and be election commissioners at the same time. Any certain county, this goes to what you're saying, any certain county, a person is running for county exec, a senator. The election commissioner didn't support him. And the election commissioner's opponent, the opponent of that senator filed objections against their petition. The election commissioner called it as they see in that county, didn't throw that person off the ballot. So he decided that he was going to get even with the election commissioner and put him out of office. So he went to a Brooklyn assemblyman who's a party chair to have his senator amend a bill that was already in, amending that no party chairs could be party chairs and election commissioner. Now, if you're going to say the fear of lack of good government, ultimately, the legislative body has total control. So where was the good government in that? And when it came back to the assembly, it was a different bill that they sent over, so they held it. That's the full story. Was not to, you know, like, hey, we didn't send this bill over there with this amendment. But the bottom line is, it goes back to when you should not be in fearful of your job at a certain period, that if you don't make a certain decision, whether it's on either side, somebody's going to come and take you out. And he did it timely. I have both bills here. That, you know, and of course, in one house they held and said, no, this is not, you know. But the end result, the guy that he wanted to take out was on the first year of a four-year term. No, he wasn't appointed. His local body appointed him to a four-year term, said that he couldn't take him out anyway. So then he went and he got the local county, he tried to get the local county board of legislators. Now this is an elected official, a state senator, to then have the local legislators in that county say, hey, okay, we support this guy. You didn't throw his opponent off the ballot. So now we're going to look into a law that prevents you going retroactive from being election commissioner. I'm just, you know, I'm saying, so you ask for reasons for things or whatever?
Well, I guess it does follow up what I was going to ask. Well,
you said it borrows.
I know there was introduction of law asking for you not to serve too. If you're going to be a party chairman, you couldn't serve as a commissioner. So what was the status of that law?
That's the law that's being held because the person tried to backdoor.
Say by some magic bullet this legislation gets passed, you've already been, the terms have been increased to 4 years. Would you have to resign one of the two positions?
Yeah.
Either you would.
Yeah, you know the crazy part. You know the crazy part about, no, it wouldn't be retroactive, but you know the crazy part of it? We don't get paid as party chair. Which one do you think I'm going to leave?
Lead party chair.
Thank you. It's a no-brainer. You know, that's why we don't. You know, and the pants.
Doug,
I'm not repenting.
Chair,
I have
one more question.
You have
I can take the number three position at the bottom left.
Are the commissioners established by which parties? Two parties are the highest number of voters.
Yes.
So, say the Tea Party all of a sudden became the first or the second. depending on which one of you would be asked if you'd have to leave, what would happen before your turn?
Glenn Beck would be asking for a new commission.
One of the parties. So the four-year term wouldn't mean anything.
No.
Probably not.
No.
They take over probably January 1st.
No. Whether it's the independent party, the positions are set up statewide by the parties who get the largest number of votes in the gubernatorial
election.
The two
majority elections.
Right. The two majority. It could be if the Conservative Party gets the largest number of votes in the Working Family Party, then they would then head the Board of Elections statewide.
You know something we don't?
Don't lose sleep over.
Any other questions?
The chair, the term for this would start really starts January 1st. And after,
of 2011.
2011.
Right.
So the kind of answer to your question is the same as that. As far as if the legislation would somehow pass, it would probably be effective for January 1st or whatever, if it got there.
Our
legislation. The state legislation that
if it gets passed.
If it gets passed, if they come
would
back.
Take effect subsequently.
Right, but
this being a gubernatorial year, if Tea Party was to gain the second position, they would take over the Board of Elections January 1st,
they would take over the Board of Elections. So it
and its term starts January 1st.
Yeah.
Thank you,
any other questions? Do I have a motion to proceed to schedule a public hearing and put this on the agenda?
So moved.
Second. For all purposes.
All purposes.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. There you go. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Next topic is the proposed tax levy cap legislation, and we're going to have two speakers, I believe. We have Chairman Jenkins, who is the sponsor, one of the sponsors.
Yeah, which I wasn't mentioned. Yeah, I know you were a sponsor. Weren't you still a co-sponsor?
It's a chair, I can't do it. Unless I'm the only
sponsor. No.
And then we have Rachel Estroff. Ms. Estroff, you're here, right?
Yeah.
So you, thank you for your patience.
Okay.
As you see, we have a lot on the agenda today.
Did the Housing Committee also?
Yes, we
were.
Yeah.
We're
yeah. Right.
Oh,
yeah.
So Mr. Chair, is the two speakers are, again?
That's
okay.
Mr. Chairman Jenkins has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before the members of this honorable committee is a proposal, proposed legislation to create a tax cap for a tax levy cap, basically, for Westchester County. The proposed legislation said that it would be 3% or the cost of living index, which is from the consumer price index, all urban consumers, whichever percentage is less. By the way, that what it is right now is somewhere around 1%. It excludes, the legislation excludes the cost for benefits, based on the health care benefits and retirement benefits, and there was a good reason for that, and I refer the members of the committee to the budget that we enact. And our budget act that we enact, for every department, we see the department tax levy, and then we see the department total, which includes the miscellaneous budget items for the retirement systems and health insurance and benefits. So though we're able to break those out, it's not something that we would have to figure out, quote unquote. We would be able to see that clearly. And what it would do, we asked in the initial memorandum of legislation to have a way of having the community, should they decide that they would want us to invest more tax levy dollars on a specific item or a specific area, that they could by referendum make that modification. And the county attorney, and Linda was here, right? Look, Linda, come on down, since Linda helped. You know, Linda drafted this.
Right.
This item.
Yeah, I forgot.
Right?
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
I want to apologize. I forgot to mention our budget director, Larry Solis. You'll address us as well?
Sure. Do you want me to
come on?
Yeah, have a seat, please. Okay. Yes. There's a seat here for you. Right. Might as well all come up and sit around the table. All the speakers. And Legislator Abernathy, if you finished your lunch, you should. And I forgot to mention we've been joined by Legislator Robbie. He's been here for a while now. Okay, Ken, sorry.
No problem. So in asking for this law to be drafted, again, is that it would give us the certainty as far as the tax levy increase that would potentially be imposed from the Board of Legislators. It would give us the certainty of a range. It also would be helpful for the administration because they would also understand that range in shaping the budget, and departments certainly would be able to be guided by that. But more importantly, certainly in a case like this year where the county executive has made clear that he's targeting and trying to have a zero tax levy, someone asked why we would not include that in here. And I said, no, you need to have a range that is based on the numbers that are cost of living. You know, things, you know, cost more. And as we've seen over the years, our health insurance cost and our pension insurance cost have climbed. But I also wanted to make sure to note on the record, Mr. Chairman, that, you know, for the retirement systems, for example, there were years where we did not make any contribution to the retirement system when the pension system was doing well. It was several years in a row. So this has been kind of a new phenomenon where we haven't had such good performance in our stock market, and therefore there's a requirement for us to have a contribution at a specific level. By excluding those, since we do not control those, it gives us the better control. Every other cost that we have, we, at the end of the day, have some direct control of those costs. So that was the proposal, Mr. Chairman. If there's anything, Ms. Trenikos, in developing the legislation, did note in the memo from Bob Meehan that there was not a way for us to put in that portion to do the lifting of by referendum, and if she could expound on that a little bit, then...
Would you like to? Go ahead.
Right.
There's a number of attorney generals in Fremont.
Yes, in connection with that. You can't have a local law subject to a referendum unless there's specific authorization in state law. Since there is none for this particular instance, unless we have state legislation amended for these purposes, we would not be able to include that in this legislation. One other note to address one of the things that Legislator Jenkins had mentioned. This was drafted in accordance with his proposal. There are arguably other costs which are set by the state and outside of the county's control, but those were not taken into consideration in this proposal. But there is still that limitation of the 3% in connection with those costs as well.
Those are the other unfunded mandates.
Exactly.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask that you repeated? That answer was not clear to me. Why this would not require a referendum? I mean, it's limiting the power of legislators.
Wouldn't require
this does require a referendum. That was not what was requested. The issue with respect, this is subject to a mandatory referendum.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought. Yeah, okay.
The tax levy legislation is subject to a mandatory referendum.
This legislation itself is subject to a mandatory referendum. What I was just discussing is Legislator Jenkins had requested that a provision be provided here which would allow the public to have a referendum in the event that there would be an increase greater than 3%.
If they wanted to
justify the cost.
Correct.
And for that.
And we cannot have referenda except where
state law.
Except where the state law allows you to.
Exactly. That was
there's lots of decisions that say that, right.
So in order to do that, we would, for that particular provision, we would actually need to request, you know, a modification in the state law.
No, you might need a change of the state constitution.
I'm not sure, but you're right, probably. Right?
You probably need a change in the state constitution
to do that. But that being said, Mr. Chairman, that was the...
Right, she on the staff? Well,
I okay. Let's say Rogowski has a question.
Well, let's get that. Let's get that clarified. Council, is that the state constitution or a state law? Dealing with what you can have a referendum on.
Republican.
There are many cases in connection with the attorney general's opinions. The specific provisions that allow for the referendum are in municipal home rule law and the constitution.
So it is in the Constitution as well?
With respect to what laws can be adopted by local entities. Yes.
Okay. So it would be a constitutional change. Okay.
Let's say on the legislation, were we to consider this legislation, it seems to me from a drafting point of view that we would have to identify the CPI index, you know, as the 12 months ending the October, you know, some that the legislation has drifted, as drafted, to, you don't know if it's the 1 month, 3 months, in what year, you know, so it's just, it's there's a draft, from a drafted point of view, you have to address that.
Well, what was utilized here is exactly that. There is, if you go onto the Department of Labor website.
Oh, I look at it often.
And you're correct. At
but
the time,
you have to have a date. Period. You have to have a period. Yeah. 12 months ending September. I mean, for drafting the budget or us voting on the budget.
The problem is, though, at the time that the first budget is drafted, I think there's a...
Well, it changes every month.
Exactly.
It changes every month.
So,
well, but the way it's drafted, this can't work the way it's drafted. Because
well,
it has no date.
It leaves it
right,
up.
Right, right now it has no date. Exactly.
And is it the 1 month? Pick 1 month? Pick 6 months? Because it gives you... Most people look at it year over year, but you could argue...
Yeah.
The bureau gives it to you a monthly, you know. So I'm just saying, were we to prove before we have to just
clarify
July, you know, pick a date so everybody or whatever. But having said that, I am determined, Mr. Chairman, once in this legislative term, to find some legislation that I can agree with my friend from Yonkers. But
this
once
is it,
again,
right?
This is not it. But this is not it. This is not it by a long shot. It seems to me that he's, you know, he's excluded. Healthcare and retirement system. But first, let me say, as a more macro policy, I really don't understand why we would put a limitation on ourselves. I understand the state legislature wants to say we're going to pass a law capping school taxes at 3% or capping county taxes. You know, capping someone else, assuming they have the power to do that, they can do that. We sit here as a county government. We vote on our budgets, and last year it was 2.9, it was a 1.7 the year before that. So the very fact, why would we cap ourselves? We're not capping a town or a village. So from a public policy, I don't see us, I don't know why I would want to vote on any law that would simply cap what we do every December.
It's like
the
eminent domain law.
And I similar law and eminent domain, and the same philosophy, that's why I don't support that. But going to the merits of this, how dangerous would it be? You've taken out two. You have the state takes STOA aid away from us. They change the probation reimbursements. Medicaid does go up 3%. And I can go down to early childhood intervention. I can list 250 programs where either the mandate goes up or the reimbursement goes down. And we'd be great if we lock our hands and say, well, good, health care and pensions, right? Some of those pensions, you have a good stock market year, the pension wouldn't even be an issue. I can't begin to imagine what costs won't be reimbursed as much, what things will go up, utilities go up. I mean, we deal with all these things. So the very idea of trying to cap, and then now what happens, you know, we're going to be in violation of our own law. So just, I mean, I can give you 15 reasons why I just... It's a good effort, maybe, to try to look at the spending side. I just don't see it. Try again.
Let's take Abernathy.
Yeah, I'm a little troubled by the concept of trying to put artificial caps, whether it's a zero cap, a 3%, or a 10%. Along the lines of what Ms. Legowski just said, it's sending the message to the public, number one, that what we do is not important, because money is more important than the services we render, and that somehow you can artificially put a cap on what these are going to cost and what we're going to do. It's kind of like rationing and say, well, we have this amount of money, and so these services are not as important as the tax rate. I think that's totally counter to what we've been saying all along, that we're basically doing what we have to do for our community. And so you can't ration it. And secondly, it's then saying also that we haven't been doing a good job, that we have to put an artificial limit on what we're doing to control ourselves, when in fact we have been doing a good job. In fact, we have come back with only the minimum tax increases that we've needed to fund the services that we deem as necessary. And every year we squeeze more and more, and we cut out more and more services, and we say, you know, well, you know what, these are important or these are good or whatever, but they're not necessary. And there are a lot of us who think we're down now to the necessary services. And so when you get to a point where you have a bad year, what do you tell the public? Well, these necessary services are just not necessary because we've artificially limited ourselves. So, and I think that's part of what's wrong with the conversation out there today, which is people are not looking at what the services are and how important the services are. And actually what a good deal we get from a government like the county government and how inexpensively we provide services. And this kind of shifts the conversation the other way. So I have a problem from the macro picture with doing anything in this area.
I'm not sure if people out there think we're providing
services. I agree with you.
Can we move to the speakers who've been waiting?
Sure, let's see.
And then we'll have further questions since even another meeting. And Ms. Estros has been waiting a long. Do you mind, Mr. Soule, letting Ms. Estros go first?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that okay? Because she's been here since 1 o'clock.
No, that's fine. But I have little handouts for everyone, so
green.
Let me introduce Ms. Estros. She is a constituent of mine.
Okay.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be here, Chairman. Thank you, Legislator Rogowski, for inviting the initiative. I'm with Westchester for Change. We're a grassroots group organizing for political change. And I also work with the Omnibus Consortium, which is a statewide organization working on tax reform. And I'm very concerned about the cap on the levy. Obviously, residents are feeling great pain over property taxes, and I appreciate the effort to begin to address this. It's often cited that New York State local taxes are 79% higher than the national average. But over the past 30 years, they've been consistently going up. But over that same period, we've also seen, and as one of your handouts illustrates, a dramatic decline in income taxes. And this is all happening while we're seeing greater polarization, the widest income gap between the top and the bottom in the nation, and as well as across the state. New York State actually has the widest income gap of all states, between the poor, the wealthiest, mm-hmm. and the poorest. It has one of the highest gaps between the middle income and the highest income as well. So despite the political appeal, which I absolutely understand, of a cap, I think there are great problems with it. To begin with, as others have said, you really lack the control over so much of your spending through mandates from the state. So it seems unwise, just sort of from that perspective, to put a cap. And then I think even more fundamentally, it doesn't provide the relief that people need. The truth is that putting a 3% cap on your portion of the levy just does. I mean, levies have not been that high over the past few years. The problem has been loss of assessment and loss of state aid across both here in the schools and the local level as well. So someone paying 30% of their income in property taxes is not going to be helped if it only they're and it's not even that the 3% translates into 3% on their portion of the county piece it doesn't translate that way. So not only does it undermine your obligations to residents, it also doesn't address the problem. And there are alternatives. I mean, as all of this suggests, we need to fund things differently. And I mean, I know that you have worked very hard to try to get the state to take over its obligations, but that's where we need to focus our effort. Over the long term, we need to fund things through in a more progressive way, in a more equitable way. So rather than tying your own hands, I ask you to join me in calling on the state to provide the aid that you're entitled to, and funding things not just, I mean, I understand that your objective would be the things that affect you, the county government, but overall, funding things in a more fair way. And then in the short term, there are proposals that have been put forward by the Omnibus Consortium and supported by the League of Women Voters and AARP to institute a circuit breaker that would actually provide people a rebate on their taxes so that it's based on what people can pay rather than entirely on, you know, some arbitrary assessment. So where there are efficiencies, I absolutely ask you to find them and, you know, to address them. But the best form of relief is not a cap, but it's long-term, it's funding things differently, and in the short term, it's working to provide a circuit breaker. Thank you for the time.
Any questions? Mr. Soule?
I mean, I'll say, if you want to wait.
Questions, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Any questions for
you?
No,
I have a question. Just to understand the proposal, is this on the gross amount or is this on the tax percentage increase?
Tax percentage.
So, but it's the gross amount that increases?
Correct.
So if we were to have a circumstance, one of the reasons we have a, if we have a circumstance where the economy turns around, and all of the properties are worth a lot more. I'm just trying to understand the maybe you can address this. Trying to understand the relationship of this proposal to the value of property in the county. Right at the moment, one of the reasons I believe people are feeling it so badly is we're in a dip. And so there are people who have stagnant incomes, people who are unemployed, and people whose property is worth far less than what they paid for it. And so the property tax increases in some cases are higher because the properties are worth less. So the town of Greenberg might have to have a 6% tax increase just to stay where they were last year because so many of the properties have had tax certiorari's and dropped the overall value. Mr. Burton is nodding his head here so he can explain it better than I can if I fumble through this. On the other hand, if we start to go back up again, and now all of the values shoot back up, they might very well increase the tax spending dramatically with very little tax increase.
Why?
because the value upon which
you can't reassess. You can't reassess. Just because they went up in value, you can't reassess.
But you may not have the same drop from year to year. Part of the problem is every year there's a significant drop. So if you just stay steady, and then you might be okay. You hold spending. I mean, the school districts complain about this all the time. They're spending less, but their taxes are going up at 2 or 3.
You're pushing the taxes.
No one comes in to get the taxes raised.
It never goes back up. You're right. Correct. It never goes back up.
So that's why your analogy didn't work.
Then assessments don't go up.
Well, no, but it won't drop. It won't drop.
Let's give Mr. Solis.
At any rate, so yes. I'm a little concerned about how this plays
That's
out, given that.
That's not entirely true, because the state real property board changes the formula.
You're right.
And
thank
the formula
you.
Goes
You're right.
Good
thank
point.
You.
Yep.
That's the point. So it does go up. You're
yes,
right.
It does go up.
So it would have an impact. But it's just so very complicated, and it is another thing that we'd have to look at if we're going to consider this kind of legislation.
I'll wait till Mr.
Yeah,
let's
hear Mr. Solis.
I mean, I agree with the comments that I think that to impose this at the county level, I think it is problematic in that we don't control unfunded mandates from the state. If something has to be done, it should be done at the state level. And even the state the governor has proposed a cap. It didn't get passed this year. I think National Association of Authority.
There's actually one proposal that did actually pass the Senate. It's been delivered to the Assembly.
But it hasn't passed the Assembly.
It has not passed the Assembly.
And I think, the National Association or the Association of Counties has come up with a position on this, that they feel that if a cap is going to be put in place, there has to be some link to unfunded mandates. And I know there are other proposals like circuit breaker proposals, et cetera, that may make more sense than a property tax cap. And when you look at California as a prime example of where it really hasn't worked as intended. I think that, so that's one of the problems is the unfunded mandates. And most of what we do are mandated by either the state or the feds indirectly through the state. So I think that's something we have to look at. Also, you touched on the calculation. I mean, it has to be defined for this CPI. This is a technical issue. But, are you going to, I think the governor's proposed bill had a 12-month period that ended prior to when the budget is adopted. And you compare that to the prior 12-month period. If we were to do that, say, through June of this year, we're looking at 0.8%. So if it's a lesser of, we're looking at less than a 1%. Now, the other thing is the governor's bill had a floor in it. You should look at that because if we're talking about deflation, which is something that's now being bantered about, you're looking at a reduction as opposed to limiting the increase. So just kind of a technical thing. I think the other thing is it doesn't touch on revenue projections. Obviously, that's a loophole. If, a proposal is for a 4% increase in economically driven revenues and Bennett Kielsen or whoever comes back and says, well, we think it should be 8%. I mean, there's some loophole there because it's really the net impact on the tax levy. So I think there's something there to maybe consider. So I think, those are two things, and I think we have to look at it from a credit rating standpoint. I mean, we're AAA. We're probably one of the only, I think we may be the only county in the state that's left that's AAA. That, obviously that's based on our ability to raise taxes, and we may come in with a zero this year, but who knows down the road if we get unfunded mandates, and I'm not saying that that's, looking ahead, but I think that it's something that I think just has to be looked at from the long-term perspective, and I think it's something that has to be implemented at the state level as opposed to the local level.
And I think you have in our packet Steve Aquario's letter from NYSAC, which raises the issue of the unfunded mandates. Mm-hmm. There's also a proposal, I think, that Attorney General Cuomo has raised with respect to 2% for cost of living increase, which is even lower.
Same fundamental problem.
Chairman Jenkins.
Thank you. And there's a few different things. First, I think, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for not just only co-sponsoring it, but to try to get the conversation going. And I appreciate the point that I don't want to call your first name. Ms. Estra. Right? We try to be formal on this. Except with each other. You know, we try to be formal, Ms. Estra. Thank you. From the position to say what change has to happen and that we need to do. Well, the first thing is that we had to do is try to do a stake in the ground. And certainly what I'm hopeful that we'll have from our conversation today, even if it's just the start of saying we're going to have a public hearing that says let's hear more from the public to hear different ideas that go on. I mean, we know this is not it, right? And I hope that from Mr. Rogalski's perspective, we can get to a place where it is, right? That it's something that we all do. We know we have to do something to help control the cost. And yes, we're tying our hands in one way. But then it'll give us the impetus to work with our state legislature at a different level. Because you know this year, as the chair of the legislation committee, we did it through government reform, efficiency, and savings. I mean, we minimized our state package and the things that we were asking for. Mr. Rogalski and Mr. Ryan have been talking about years of trying to do relief and mandates. And we know that's really where the angle is going to get, and whether we get mandate relief by dollars or we get mandate relief by someone allowing us the flexibility to do it in a way that's different, that's going to be the challenge that I see. I think that, if we limited spending in a specific area, we would have what happened in Yonkers, where in their budget proposal, where they limited the tax increase to 4%, and then they said, we're going to go to garbage pickup one time a week, right? When they said we were going to lay off firefighters and police officers, nobody cared, right? They were like, less overtime and all that other kind of thing, whether it's true or not. But when they said, when people started getting garbage piling up in front of their house, they said, we're willing to increase our income tax surcharge to pay for that, right? And that's when you have that level of pressure. So I don't think any of us have the answer, right? As you mentioned with Governor Cuomo's, Andrew Cuomo running for governor proposal. What can I tell you? I read the news.
Right?
I'm a Democrat. What can I tell you? But at the end, the reality is a 2%. And his proposal is a 2% cap, right? Ours is trying, the one that I'm proposing is one that says it's time to the cost of living. We certainly have to figure out what that time frame is, and I think we should hear from different experts on what that should mean. The deflation is certainly a big concern for all of us about when we are investing. And part of the reason government has to continue to invest, because if everybody stops spending, deflation is definitely going to be the end result of that. The circuit breaker, I don't believe, is any different, by the way, than a cap, right? It's a cap on income versus a cap on percentage, right?
No, it's very different. It's very. I mean, I don't. You can go ahead, but it's very different than the cap. I mean, should I say?
Go ahead.
What it does is it allows that people would only spend, and this would be set by the state, a certain percentage of income on property taxes. So it would probably be phased in, so it starts at maybe 10%, 9%, and eventually drops to 6%, 7% of their income. And then whatever percentage it's over, you would get a 70% rebate. So it's you fund it through either increase, you could either use the STAR or you use income, you return to more progressive income tax.
Well, I mean, the thing is always interesting. Again, on whatever it is, it's a cap, right, on something that causes the circuit breaker in the way that you explained, and I thought I understood it that way, is that basically we're still, we're giving back money that we should have never took, right? And that's part of the assessment battle that we're working through, and the board has been very instrumental in trying to help to get that piece fixed. There's many pieces of the puzzle that have to get fixed, but we have to put a stake in the ground and to start somewhere, and do respect for everyone's considerations to get to, you know, have the public hearing, at least to put it out for public hearing, to start that process. Because, Mr. Chairman, you know this is going to be, this is going to go through several iterations before whatever is shaped, if something is shaped, to do it. But I think that, you know, taking this step in a direction that says, you know, we're being fiscally responsible, and while Mr. Abenanti's not here, most people don't seem to feel that from any elected official. It's not just the county level. They think, you know, we're just spending money on whatever, right? And they're not realizing what that is. And the point that Mr. Abenanti was raising and what we're spending money on is extremely important. However, people aren't hearing that right now because either they feel they're paying too much of their taxes or whatever. But whatever reason, we have to start somewhere to have that level of discussion. So, I mean, Mr. Chairman, if it was...
So what's your...
My suggestion, Mr. Chairman, is that, you know, from a starting point, that we at least, you know, have a public hearing... that we vote out to have a public hearing on this topic, and then it would be coming back, not for all purpose, just for public hearing, consumption, to hear the things.
There's a motion.
That is my motion.
To put forward this proposal
as public hearing.
For a public hearing only. Is there a second? I'll second. Oh, you're Legislator Williams. Okay, so for public hearing only.
Yeah, public hearing only. It is not, you know, limiting.
Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, I really never like to vote against setting a public hearing because, in theory, we're just asking the public. However, you know, when we take actions here, we're sending messages. And if the public may not just understand, well, it's just a public hearing, start, they're going to see, you know, legislative committee, you know, votes out 3% cap, you know, schedules public hearing. If we want to have a dialogue on property tax reform, I mean, I have my proposals in on deferring taxes when hit age 70, circuit breakers. We can certainly pass a resolution calling for a public hearing or some symposium, you know, all kind of generally.
Your proposal, has it been submitted to legislation?
It has been sent to legislation, I guess. It has been. I did put on the agenda. I don't forget which committee it went to. But we can work on that. But my point is, I'm all in favor of having discussions and dialogues on property tax reform. If we vote out this particular bill, I mean, I don't think that's the vehicle to get a debate on property tax reform. Voting out a bill that the public will at least think, well, that's what the legislature is working on, a 3% cap, and they'll come and discuss a 3% cap. If we want them to discuss circuit breakers and all forms of property tax reform, that should be what we're asking for. So
you want to respond?
I hate to vote against them, but I think I would have to vote against setting a public hearing on this bill because I think this really sends the wrong message.
I tried, Mr. Rogowski, to get him to vote for yes.
Not even on a public hearing.
It's the motion I made on the floor to have a public hearing that is public hearing only. It absolutely is coming back here. No one should get the wrong message other than saying we are interested from hearing from the public on what they feel on the tax cap.
We haven't heard from you yet. We want to hear from you.
You're going to hear from me because I don't think you need to have a public hearing. First of all, you could have discussions. You could have anybody come up here, okay, and let them sit on that seat and talk about what their ideas are, what they expect, what they want, okay? But on this, I'm not ready for this, okay? And people will be calling us for days and days and weeks at a time because I don't know if they're going to perceive it that way or the way I see it.
Yeah. With all due respect, Mr. Chair, what I think we should do is put this on for a further meeting and any other proposals we should put on the same day and continue the discussion just so we have... Is everyone okay with that?
I'm also being concerned about the time frame and only because I understand our calendar that from setting a public hearing, that means we would have a public hearing. If you set one on the 7th, that you would have a public hearing at the end of September, and then we'd be back in committee for at least a month.
Yeah, but remember, this needs a mandatory referendum. Absolutely. This can't go forward until next 2011.
We also have a budget process that is being overlaid at the same time.
But this isn't going to be effect to govern that government. I just think we ought to have a further discussion. Anybody else have any other proposals to lay on the table? We'll discuss them side by side.
Can I please just ask you a question? Because we talked about Yonkers, and as a representative like you from Yonkers, the phone was off the wall. Now, okay, that happened last year. I don't think things are going to get better, okay? I think we are still in a recession, and I think it'll take 2 or 3 years at least, okay? Now, are the same people going to say, raise my income tax next year and the year after?
No.
They're not going to want that. No. But what's going to change? You're going to do the same thing with the garbage again.
Right, and that's actually the point again. It's
so, Mr. Chair, can I ask you to withdraw the motion for now? Or?
I will withdraw the motion right now, Mr. Chairman. But
before that motion is withdrawn, you're still on discussion.
Yes.
I just want to say very quickly that because of the unique role that counties have in the system of governments, local government, county, state, federal, knowing what our responsibilities are under the law, most significantly the state laws that pretty much govern what it is that we do and assign the service delivery responsibilities we have as the administrative arm of the state. Considering, as Larry mentioned, the state mandates, considering the very complex intergovernmental financial relationship that exists between counties and the state, Westchester and New York, I have had a long history of not supporting artificial tax caps. I don't support them. I wouldn't support this. I wouldn't support the governor's at 2%. It's not the answer to getting under control of the problem that we have. The answer clearly is trying to achieve efficiencies in economies and how all service delivery takes place. I think that to put this topic out, and I know, you know, Ken's very concerned about finances and burdens on taxpayer, and I appreciate the good work that he's done, but to put this topic out in front of the Westchester resident raises expectations, I'm sure it would, among many of them. Now the debate no longer is the proper way to go about doing something to control costs and deliver services. Now it could be the tax cap, the extent of the cap. The cap doesn't go far enough. It should be higher. It should be more. I think that if we're going to put something out for commentary, it should be something that we would actually at some point really consider using. I know as one legislator, I would never vote for us to get into a position where we would be using artificial tax caps to structure the budget that we have to put together, especially in light of the burden that we're under with respect to our responsibilities under the law.
Okay. So,
like I said, I was withdrawing the motion, and we'll take care of this over the next couple of weeks.
Right.
To have an additional meeting and have additional folks in, and then hopefully we'll be able to have it in a shape that we can send.
Any other legislators have any other proposals for property tax relief? Please put them on the agenda. We'll discuss them, and we'll have a discussion of anybody's proposal for as long as we need to. Thank you. We have two. Thank you, Ms. Estroff. Thank you, Larry Saul. Thank you, Linda Tricoste. And we have two appointments to move. One is the appointment of Stephen Jones to the Industrial Development Agency, and one of Donald Heithouse to the Airport Advisory Board. And I'll let.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The subcommittee
on appointments reports both of these appointments favorably, and we ask that you all support.
We have a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Okay.
All in favor? Aye.
The,
aye. Opposed?
The Committee on Housing, Planning, and Operations will adjourn now. I have a motion to that effect.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Second. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We will now reconvene. The Committee on Housing Government.
What do we do in 3 minutes?